Michael asked me to speak in December, and so I've had like 9 months to worry about it or think about it. And you know, it's truly an honor to speak at this sort of function, and also to be trusted that I can carry the message. Louder! This fucking thing doesn't work. Did I say that? The microphone. It doesn't bite?
No.
Is that what you said? You sure? I don't know. Is that better?
Yeah.
Don't touch it.
Don't touch it.
Touch it and it doesn't bite? Wow. I was young once. You guys are awesome. That countdown was amazing. And welcome to the newcomers and those of you that feel like newcomers. Especially those under 30 days. Oh, and the two of you that came up here. Oh, it was so awesome. I'm so glad that you guys are here tonight. And I can't imagine being in this kind of room, in this environment, my first 30 days of sobriety. I was scared and nervous and worried, and there's no way I could have been in this kind of room with you kind of people. It was certainly. Anyways, my sobriety date is November 18th, 1984. Probably before some of you were born. Thank you. It's all one day at a time. You know, I didn't drink and I didn't die. And in the moments that I wanted to drink and I wanted to die, I didn't, because the people that went before me taught me that you don't drink and you don't die no matter what. And I didn't. And, you know, I've had some hard times in sobriety, and I've gotten through them. And I foresee there'll probably be other hard times and there'll be other great times. And we just get through them. I was born in 1968. So for those of you that don't get out your computers or your phones to do math, I'm 43 years old. Thank you. I was born in Seattle to an alcoholic family. My father's an alcoholic, my mother's an anorexic, and the only reason that I share that is because it shows that there's addiction in my family. My mother was a codependent. I always say she's a skinny caregiver. Who took care of my alcoholic father, who, you know, was, I don't remember much of him. He left when I was three, and never came back. And, alcohol was more important than his children were. And, you know, as an alcoholic, I get that. As a parent, I don't. I have two daughters who I love more than anything in this world. And, but again, as an alcoholic, I understand that thinking. We lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, that's where I grew up. My mother, when I was about six, married a doctor. And I think she probably married him to take care of her children, not really because she loved him too much, more so just to take care of us. I had a younger brother, and we lived a, quote, normal life. Until I hit about the age of five, when I was walking home from a friend's house. And why I was outside at the age of five, I'm not sure. I've asked my mother this many times. And I don't let my five-year-old out of the house, but, you know, when I was little, that was a long time ago. You know, you guys weren't born yet, some of you. I was walking home. I had a new dress on, and I was going to show my girlfriend this new dress. And I was walking home, and I got hit by a car. A man did not see me, and he hit me, and my shirt was attached to his wheel well as he hit the car, as he hit me, and he thought he had a flat tire. And he kept driving, and I was underneath his car as he drove. I drug under his car, and it was by the grace of God he stopped when he did. And I today I have my arm is paralyzed from that, and I have a seizure disorder from it. And I was left to die on the street, basically, because I had some massive brain injury as well. And I think it was just kind of a God thing that I'm here today. My mom was the first one to the scene of the crime. The scene of the crime wasn't really a crime, but it was an accident. And this, I felt for this poor old man that hit me. It was truly an accident. and went to the hospital, started having grand mal seizures, and the doctors told my mother that I would never live, and if I did, I would be in a vegetative state for the rest of my life, so just to call the relatives and count their blessings. Obviously, God had another plan for me, because here I am 40-some years later. And what happened for me is when I went back to school as a first grader, I felt different. I felt unusual. I felt, you know, my arm was different, and I was bald because I had to have a lot of brain surgeries. And, you know, as a kid, we're not supposed to be different. And kids are mean, and they tease us, and I was called handicapped and ugly and fat, and I've always been a little overweight and ugly and ridiculed really badly. And so what I found is that my grandmother, who became my best friend because she liked to drink, always had alcohol out for me. She had little scotch glasses out on her table. So by the time I was 6, I found that if I drank a few shots of scotch, it made me feel good. And it's really hot in here. You guys all sweating like a pig like I am? Or is it just me having a hot flash? See what you're looking forward to? Aren't you all excited? anyway, so I discovered that this alcohol thing was a really, like, made me feel really great. And, you know, life just went on. It wasn't really a big thing, except that I was, you know, again, I was different. I had this weird arm. I was this weird kid. I had been out of school for a year because I had to be in a hospital bed at home. I had to be tutored at home. By the time I was 8, I feel like I crossed that invisible line of addiction, of alcoholism, and I know it sounds, we're all young, we all are young in here, a lot of us are super young, and when I got sober, people said, I spilled more than you drank, and I was like, I'm sorry you were lousy drunk, you know? You know, we cross that line, and that those feelings of that incomprehensible demoralization that it talks about in the big book, you know, we cross that line, and that's what happened for me, is that by the time I was 8 years old, I discovered that raiding my parents' liquor cabinet and filling up glasses of, you know, big glasses of anything I could find in their cabinet, their liquor cabinet, filling it up, and it made me feel good. I fell down, I laughed. Suddenly I wasn't, quote, handicapped. I felt normal. And I laughed. I felt pretty. I wasn't fat anymore. I wasn't ugly. I was normal. And and it made me feel really great. What started happening for me was probably like it happens for the rest of us. You know, alcohol made me feel really good. By the time I was 12, I discovered boys. They also made me feel really good. And it was more than just a physical kind of thing. I tell my story very honestly. If it offends you, you can either leave or call your sponsor, your choice. You know, it's all about honesty for me. I was taught from the beginning of when I got sober is to tell the truth. You know, I've learned in my sobriety that that's what it's about. So I found that boys were really great. I had this incredibly huge, massive black hole inside of me, and I found that alcohol was like, yeah, alcohol's great. It's like making me feel really good. I do have drugs in my story. Marijuana was really great. I decided at 12 that smoking weed was really awesome. And that, too, made me feel really great. Anyways, you know, my story is my story, and what started happening for me by the age of about 13, you know, the boys were really like, you know, they were even getting, make me feel even really better, and I lost my virginity by the time I was 13, and smoking a lot of pot, and drinking a lot of alcohol, and starting to feel that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization was really kicking in, and I started having these visions of dying in my mind. And I started visualizing being like, I don't know, this is what I visualized. Being in my coffin at my own funeral and having those around me at my funeral being really sad and saying, we should have told her we loved her. And then like being like, yeah, you should have. Like coming awake. You should have told me you loved me more then, but not now. And so what I decided was that suicide was a great option at that point when I was about 13. That suicide was my next option. So I decided I would start, I'd try to slit my wrist. Well, slitting your wrist with one hand is tough. It is. So. I tried it with my teeth. Into my wrist. Anyways, that's a little vulgar and I'm so like, vulgarity doesn't bother me one bit. If it bothers you, I'm sorry. That I'm sorry about, but right on. So my wrists were bleeding, or this wrist was bleeding. This wrist I couldn't feel on, I should have just, you know, anyways. So I had a little blood trickling and then I washed it, no big deal. So I had this other idea, there's gotta be other ways. Now in my mind I'm thinking, you know, I really don't wanna die. I really don't. What I want is someone to pay attention to me. Someone needs to acknowledge that I am hurting. Someone needs to see that I am feeling this incomprehensible demoralization, that these drugs aren't working and this alcohol is not working and you boys are not fixing this pain inside of me. Nothing is working for me. So I asked my mom, who I was beginning to really not like at this time, because she was not liking me very much. Now, I don't know why she didn't like me. You know, I mean, really. You know, I was getting bad grades and not going to school and staying out really late and, you know, writing bad words on my bedroom wall and, you know, thick black eyeliner and, I don't know why she didn't like me, but and I called her really bad names, and she and I got in physical fights. But again, I'm not sure why she didn't like me. But I asked her one night. I said, "Now, mind you, we lived in San Francisco, and my dad's a doctor. I went to school in Ferraris. Okay, this is the lifestyle I lived. I was, you know, spoon-fed by a silver spoon. Our chief car was the Mercedes. So." Now, I don't live that lifestyle anymore, but that's what I was raised with. So I asked my mom, we have this beautiful white carpet in our 4,000 square foot house. So mom, how can a person die without, I didn't tell her this. I didn't want to slit my throat because I didn't want a scar. You know, now my body is covered in scars from this car accident that I'm in. I'm covered in scars. But I didn't want another one, you know, especially when you could see. And she's like, well, your ankle, not your ankles, there's a vein on the inside of your ankles. Now, don't go do this or think this or anything. And she says, okay. So that night I take a shower and slice up the insides of my ankles. Now, again, I don't really want to go. I just want the attention. I just want the, oh, you must be hurting. What can I do for you? I want to love you, my daughter. Now, mind you, my mom's a great mother, but she didn't do what I wanted. Now, nobody's done what I wanted my whole life until I've learned to change myself, and that was the bottom line. Anyways, told my mom, look at my ankles. Hello? I'm bleeding. You just told me this. I'm bleeding. Is there a light bulb? There was no light bulb. She says, don't get any blood on my white carpets. Wow. Okay. My third and my final attempt of my attempt of suicide was one night, I was still 14 in junior high, about ninth grade. There was a fight against my junior high and the rival junior high. Okay, I'm gonna kick some butt. You know, I'm a wuss. But I'm gonna go. Because I know I'm going to do it. We're going to get really high, we're going to get really drunk, and we're going. But I couldn't go. My parents wouldn't let me. I'm failing group school. They're like, you're not going anywhere. Oh, I'm going to show you I'm going. So I go to my room, and I take 25 Midol. Okay. Now, for you boys that don't know what Midol is, that's for period cramps. And you don't take 25 of really anything, especially Midol. And I thought, this is it. I'm going to die. I'm going to do it. I'm going out. I'm out of here. You guys are going to learn. You're going to learn. My parents, you're going to learn. I got pretty high from them, not in a good way. They are loaded with caffeine and really bad, bad, bad stuff. And I told my stepdad, I'm not doing well. He's like, what happened? I told him, roll the eyes, let's go. He takes me to the hospital he works at. We lived in a very small community. They put me put stuff on my heart. My heart's like, I have two. My heart pumped me full of stuff and just said, he came in and said, you are an absolute disgrace to this family. I can't believe what you've done to us. I work at this hospital, and now my name is in shambles because you're disgracing me. Okay. So once again, it's shown that I am a bad kid. I'm a disgrace to the family. No one is saying, we love you, we want to help you, what can we do for you? You're just a disgrace. So what they did is they sent a psychiatrist in to help me. And the psychiatrist, of course, put me on medicine to help this crazy child and this crazy little girl to get better. The psychiatrist they finally sent me to is my dad's best friend. Well, that's good. Send me to the parent's best friend. You know, not good. So I lied to the psychiatrist my whole way through, though, seeing this guy that, I'm sober. Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't do any drugs. I don't drink. No, I'm a virgin. Absolutely. Yeah. Anyways, by about 15, I was introduced to other chemicals that I won't say because this isn't that kind of meeting, by people that were trusted by my parents, that were house sitting when they went to Mexico because they did a lot of traveling because they were doctors and that's what doctors do. And they do traveling and they leave their kids alone. And they leave people that they think they can trust who put lines of cocaine on bathroom counters and say, want to try? Absolutely, I want to try. And so I was introduced to other chemicals that way. And fell in love with more stuff. And for a brief moment found that I thought I was in heaven and that I found my cure to fill up that space inside me. And what happened then is I was on a crazy roll and found that this one chemical of cocaine could make me drink longer and faster and harder. And I started doing drugs in crazy places like public McDonald's and licking bathroom seats and sleeping with men that I shouldn't have slept with, and it didn't matter. And my self-esteem went down the drain, and I just didn't care anymore. I started praying to God, please, God, I'm done. I'm done. I can't do it anymore. I don't want to live. I don't want to do this life. A 15-year-old should not live this way. A 16-year-old should not live this way. And what had happened is that line of alcoholism was crossed, and I could no longer come back. I'd be with friends, and they'd say, you need help. You need help. We don't want to hang out with you any longer. You need help. And until you get help, we don't want to be around you. You guys are, you're the ones that are crazy. I don't need help. No, we don't want to talk to you anymore. And what happened for me is I had a class in school, and I really didn't like school. I was not a fan of school. I only went because I kind of had to go. My parents made me go. But I had this one class that I really liked. I was a junior, and we had to do a report, and we could choose any topic we want to, and I say this for a reason, it sounds really ridiculous, but I chose to do my report on teenage drug abuse, and we had to interview our topic, and I was like, I can't interview a teenage drug addict. I don't know any. I mean, really? And my stepdad was a caregiver. He directed a care unit back in the Bay Area. And I said, Dad, listen, this is what I got to do. I got to find a drug addict. Can you find me a drug addict? He's like, yeah, I'll find you someone. Long story short, I was hanging out with a young man that I didn't like, but he was a little bit older than I was, and he could get my stuff for me, and he was a bad guy, and he did things to me that I didn't like, but I didn't care, and we were hanging out one night in his truck overlooking the San Francisco Bay, and I remember the song came on the radio, No One Knows What It's Like to Be the Sad Man Behind Blue Eyes by The Who. You guys may not know who The Who is, but some of you older people do. And I was like, I know what it's like to be the sad man or woman behind blue eyes. I know what it's like to be hated. I know what that's like. That's who I am. And I was, that feeling in my gut, that complete sadness and desperation washed over me once again. And I went home, and my dad said to me, I found you an AA meeting. We're going to go to it on Tuesday. This is a Sunday night. We're going to go to it on Tuesday. I was like, an AA meeting? What is that? Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, oh, my God, are you kidding me? That's like old people, and I'm 16 years old. That's going to be old people, old men, trench coats, bottles, and bags. That's what I'm seeing in my mind. He's like, there's going to be young people there. Don't you worry. We'll find you someone to interview. Okay, whatever. So went on with my next day. Went to the meeting on Tuesday. It was November 19th, 1984. And I walked into this meeting. There was about 400 people at this meeting. And I always say that it was like Dorothy, who landed in Oz, when she came off from, she landed in Oz, and she left her black and white life, and she landed into color. And that's how I say it was for me landing into this meeting. It's like how my life was. I left this black and white life, and I landed into color. And it was an amazing experience to walk into this meeting. Now, had I known my life is going to be what it is, I don't know, I would have stayed. It was an amazing experience. I sat down and I listened to the speaker. I have no idea what the speaker said, who it was. I don't know anything. All I know is that there were cute boys there, and there were women that looked really beautiful, and people were smiling, and their eyes were shining, and people actually said hello to me. People didn't talk to me. I was one of those girls that other girls didn't talk to. I was mean-looking and ugly-looking and scary-looking. And angry, and people talked to me, and I was shocked. I saw people from high school there that I saw that day that I went to school. I saw them there at that meeting that night, and I was like, why are you here? Well, maybe why you're here. Oh, no, you're not here why I'm here. I'm here because I have a report to do. You're here for another reason. Anyways, so I still had to do this report, but a young man was sitting behind me, and he said, oh, gosh, it's good to see you, da-da-da-da. I went to high school with him. Have you had a drink in the past 24 hours? I said, no. He said, come get a chip with me. I was like, what's it? I know nothing about AA. I mean, you know, as we all walk into these rooms, we know nothing about AA. So I said, well, okay, all right, whatever. So I went to get this chip. Amazing feeling inside my body. I swear to God, you know, there was like 50 of us getting a 24-hour chip. They're clapping for me. No, there's really no one else getting a chip because I am selfish and self-centered, and they're clapping for me. So I got my 24-hour chip and sat back down and said to my dad, I go, I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, you think? I was like, wow, so cool. You know, mind you, I had my girlfriends call my parents and tell them that they were my parents' friends. Oh, Kelly's spending the night at my house tonight. He's like, really? I know, she's coming home. No, she's fine. She's fine at our house. My parents are like, no, I don't think so. She's coming home. You know, there's so many tricks I tried. Now they gave in to some of them. They knew that some of them I was lying. They probably just gave in. My mom was smoking pot with me, and they did some crazy stuff just to probably give in to my addiction. But anyways, I still had to do this review or this report. I found a young man to interview. I was never going to talk to girls because girls sucked. I hated girls. And so I found a cute boy, and we went out to coffee that night, and I talked to him. I said, listen, I got to do this review or this report. I got to interview someone. Let me interview you. So we went home together that night, of course, because that's what I knew how to do, was go home with boys. And that night, we, of course, consummated our relationship. And and the next day, I interviewed him. And... And the next day we were in a relationship. So that was my introduction to AA. And I started going to meetings, and I started seeing that young people were in AA and that they had fun, and that I didn't have to drink and have fun in sobriety, and that maybe I did have a little bit of an issue with alcohol, and that maybe these people that didn't want to hang out with me, maybe they were right, and that maybe that, you know, maybe that because I didn't want to put the bottle down and share. Why? Who wants to share? And maybe that was an issue. Anyways, I was told to get a sponsor, so I did. I got Tim as a sponsor, and well, really, I mean, isn't that okay? You know, and then Tim and I slept together. I mean, isn't that okay too? I don't know. You know, I did it all wrong. I did it all wrong my first 6 months of sobriety, but I stayed sober. You know, I got a boy for a sponsor. Girls, get girls. Boys, get boys. Just a suggestion. It's a strong one. That just comes from experience. Don't get in a relationship your first year of sobriety. Why not? Well, let me tell you, I turned my will and my life over to the care of Darren as I understood him, and it didn't work because Darren wasn't God. And So Darren said to me, "I can't play God anymore," and I was like, "What?" Well, who am I going to pray to? He's like, maybe God? Oh, wow, okay. Anyway, so Darren left, and I went into treatment because I wanted to stay sober, but seriously, I had really, like, turned my will and my life into care of Darren as I understood him. Darren became my God. And I really got why they said, don't get into a relationship for your first year of sobriety. Now, some of you probably are going, you're freaking smoking crack, because I'm going to get into a lot of relationships my first year of sobriety. Again, another suggestion, do with it as you will, and you'll learn from it as you will. Just as I did. Listen to your sponsor, not me. Anyways, went to treatment, and what I got from treatment was... I was in the San Francisco Bay Area. It was a hot summer. Now, I live in Phoenix now. Now, it was hot in San Francisco, it was about 90 degrees. I live in Phoenix, 90's not hot, but I was a wuss, and it was hot then. And I always carried a jacket or over my arm, or I shoved my hand into a pocket. I never went without wearing pants with pockets because I wanted to hide my hand. Because I didn't want anybody to see me. Even when I was shit-faced drunk, I hid my hand because I was so afraid of what people would think. I don't know what of, but I was so afraid that you would judge me again. I think from being teased for so long. I mean, up into my high school years, I was teased. So when I got into treatment, one of the therapists said to me, you're taking that jacket off your arm. I was like, you're smoking crack. There's no way. And he said, no, you know, it's safe here. You're in a safe environment. It's okay to take it off your arm. It's okay to stop hiding. We don't love you for who you are on the outside. We love you for who you are on the inside. You know, it's not about who we are out here. It's about who we are in here. And I thought, okay. And we went to 5 outside meetings a week. And he said, and you need to do it out at outside meetings. I was like, there's no way, because there's people out there that I don't want them to see me like this. And, you know, I don't want to hold hands with people at the Lord's Prayer. And long story short, I finally got up the courage to do that and to hold people's hands. And it's still a, you know, 27 years later, it's still a challenge to let people hold my, quote, little hand. And I get to walk through that every time I say the Lord's Prayer with somebody that doesn't know me. And what I've learned is that we all have handicaps. Each and every one of us has a handicap. And some of us have handicaps on the inside, and some of us have them on the outside. And mine is on the outside, and you guys get to see it. And you know what? What you do with it is your business. It's not mine. You know? It's your business what you do with it. I don't get to carry your shit anymore. And it's really... Anyways, so my sobriety went on, and I got out of treatment. And then, of course, I got back together with Darren, because why not? And we stayed together for a long time and split up. Anyways... May of 87, I met my to-be husband, and I met him by, well, I never share this in meetings, I'm only sharing it because there's young people here and I feel okay sharing it. We were on our way to an AA retreat up in the woods, and there was about probably 10 cars going, and it was me and all young people. We were having a blast. I was 18 years old, and I met him by flashing him. Now, he was with other people that I knew, so it wasn't just like some guy driving down the street. I knew that he was in the program, and he was with some other men that I knew. And yeah, I was proud. It's something to be proud about. And yeah, it's something. Yeah. Anyways, that's how we met. And so we started dating a few days after that, and we were together for the next 18 years. And it was a, yeah, I wish it was aw. For those of you who know the Grateful Dead, what a long, strange trip it was. It was an adventure I had with this man. We had our first daughter when I was 20. He was 24. We got married when I was 21. We did it backwards, so we lived in sin, like none of us have. So yeah, we had Michaela when I was 20, and she's an amazing young woman now. She's 23. Thank God she's been spared from our disease so far. I can tell so far she's not been touched by our addiction. She's an amazing young woman. She's married to an army man who served a year in Afghanistan. I'm super proud of Colin. And thank you. Yeah, he's awesome. And but yeah, she's a cool girl. And we had another daughter, and 5 years later, her name's Jasmine. She's a senior in high school, and she's a cool girl too. I don't think she's been touched by our addiction either. And how these two children have turned out this way, it's a God thing. That's all I can say. They've never been around parents that drink. My ex-husband has 26 years sober. They've never been around never been around it. Been around alcohol, but not parents that drink. He and I had a pretty rough marriage. I'm not here to talk about my rough marriage, but we had a rough marriage. And we did a lot of crazy things that married people shouldn't do, not in a good, fun way, but in a yucky way. And and we decided about 7 years ago that it was time to hang the marriage up. And it was a crazy emotional time for me, and I hated it. I hated every feeling I had from it. Divorce sucks. There were moments I was in a fetal position in pain, because it was such a painful, awful, grueling experience. And there were times I wanted to drink because the pain was so bad. I called friends, I called my sponsor, I called people, I called my mom. I'm going to drink, I'm going to die. I cannot stand this pain. And what I learned is that this too, once again, this too shall pass. This too shall pass. It may suck. It may suck worse than anything you've ever felt. This too shall pass. Don't drink. Don't die. This too shall pass. Okay. I won't drink. I hope not to die. That's in God's plan. And this too shall pass. I went to meetings. I talked to people. I cried. And what happened for me is it passed. And my ex-husband and I today are friends. We're not great friends, but I'm not bitter, and he's not bitter, and he's remarried, and we live 2 miles from each other, and we do family things together. We spend holidays together. We spend our children's birthdays together. Our youngest daughter has epilepsy. We spend a lot of time in doctors together because that's what parents should do for their children, is spend time together.
Fuck yeah.
You know, they didn't cause us to have an abusive marriage. They didn't cause us. It wasn't their fault. That was about 7 years ago. Last year in December 2010, about October of 2010, I just was going along with my life and, you know, going to a lot of meetings and going to a lot of roundups and just digging my life. I bought a house, just doing what sober people do, you know, sponsoring people, doing the deal, and felt good, felt happy, nothing dramatic. Worked a job. I work for a pharmacy. I'm a drug dealer. My kids are great. Nothing too dramatic. And I'm like, God, I'm really bored. Don't ever say you're bored, ever. Don't ever tell God you're bored. Now, I've worked all 12 steps diligently. I love God. I have a great passion for God. God and I have an awesome relationship. We are buddies. And, you know, we've gone through some stuff together, he and I. And so we're chatting. I'm like, dude, I'm bored with my job. I'm bored. Yeah, call him dude. You know, I'm bored. And so, you know, I've had some issues with my kids, but whatever, we have kid issues. I have gone through the teenagers. Teenagers, we have issues. So, now, I'm doing a breast self-exam, okay? I have no one else to feel my breasts. I'm single. I gotta feel them myself. So, I find a lump. Okay, there's a lump. Oh, there's a lump. Oh, this lump's been here a while. I wonder if that's wrong. I don't know. I'm over 40, 42. What if I should have this lump checked? Nah. I'm an alcoholic. We don't have things checked. Okay, well, that's the alcoholic side of me. Now, the grown-up side of me that's been sober for a long time knows better. Okay? Because when you've been sober for a while, you learn that you get to be responsible. That's what responsible, grown-up, sober people do. Okay, I'll get it checked. I don't want to get it checked. Okay, so this is what I'm doing in my head. I have insurance. I mean, there's really no reason to not get this checked. Okay, so I get it checked. Get a mammogram. Tech goes, I go, don't say to an alcoholic, ever. Don't these people know better? So, she says, we're going to take a few more films. Okay. Now, I've been through medical stuff. I work in the medical field, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so she comes back in. Okay, bye. She's about to put my shirt back on. Okay, bye. So they call me, and they're like, we need you to have an ultrasound. That's not good. Okay, so I have an ultrasound done. Doctor comes in, he says, you need to have a biopsy. Okay. I said, so doc, does it look like cancer? What does it look like? He says, you need to have a biopsy. We need to biopsy that spot. Okay. So now I have to wait. This is a Thursday. I have to wait till Tuesday. Really? You're going to make me wait for that many days? And in the meantime, I go to a Roundup in Havasu. So it got my mind off of this whole thing, thank God. I went with my really great friend. We went to Havasu, and we had a good time, listened to great speakers, and got to sit on the water and go on a boat and really, you know, relish in my sobriety and that. I'm really thankful to be alive. Go to the thing on Tuesday. I have to wait two more days. Who are these people kidding? I mean, I have to wait for this shit. Anyways, they call me up. Doctor says, Miss, yeah? You have cancer. Now, I've been through a lot, as some of you guys have heard, just a little tiny bit of what I've been through in the 43 years of my life. Cancer is the scariest thing for me to go through ever. I'm terrified of cancer. Terrified of cancer. Cancer and my children dying. My two biggest fears. Now, oh, where am I going to go there? I'm terrified. I have what? You have breast cancer. Well, okay. Hang the phone up, start sobbing. I'm at work. I'm at work. And this man tells me I have breast cancer. Okay. So I'm sobbing at work. Call him back, because of course now I don't know what to say or what to do or who to do it with. I want to rip my breast off, because I don't know what else to do with it, except I want to rip it off and just throw it away, because that's what I want to do. Just go away. But of course I can't, because that's not possible. I call him up. What kind of breast cancer do I have? What does it look like? It appears as though you have the most common cure, most common kind of breast cancer. Okay, great. What does that say? What does that tell me? What do I do? He says, you know what? I don't know. Okay. He said, all I can tell you is you have breast cancer. And what I can tell you as well, Miss, is that next year you will be at the Susan G. Komen race. And ma'am, you are a survivor. Oh, fuck. I am a survivor. You're absolutely right, doctor. I am a survivor. You know nothing. I am a survivor. So the next year of my life was about doctors and surgery, having my breasts, both of them, removed, because I had two huge tumors in my left breast and in my lymph nodes. Doctor said, we have to remove one breast. I said, take them both, man. I don't want either of them. And just take them, because you know what? I can't do this again. This is too emotional. It's too scary. I can't do it again. Take them both. Because you know what? There's a chance it's going to spread to them both. And when they did the biopsy of my right breast, there was atypical cells in it, so I was going to have it in the other one. So, you know, I was thankful I had them both taken off. Obviously, I got new ones. Now, I want a new breast. For a long time, I want a new breast. Be careful what you pray for. After my mastectomy, 6 weeks later, I started chemo. I had 6 months worth of chemo. I lost all my hair. Now, my hair started falling out in these big, massive clumps. And I have these two children who love to do anything to mess their mother up. So they got the razor out, the, what's that called? Clippers, thank you. We sat outside, they put a plastic bag over my shoulders and started cutting my hair off. Oh my God, I started sobbing my eyes out. Now, mind you, I'm sitting here with no breasts, okay, which is the identity of a woman. I could care less if these are gone. Don't take my hair. I am sobbing. They give me a mohawk. Take pictures. This is our mom. Look how hot she is. I'm like, I am not hot. No, mom, you're hot. Do you get how hot you are? Do you get how fucking strong you are? Do you get it, mom? I was like, whoa. I don't get it, but I'm glad you do. Then, not only do they do that, then they have to bick my hair, right? Then they have to bick it. So it's totally shaved. Like Mr. Clean, right? I mean, I like have a shiny head. So I did chemo for 6 months, was bald, was sick. Oh God, was I sick. Sick as a dog. I didn't get off the couch for about 6 months. Lost about 40 pounds. I was like, dude, I'm skinny. Obviously it came back. Sorry. Sorry. Cause I started eating. You know, it's funny what happens when you eat. Did radiation for another 2 months. And then started living my life again. I have a lot of side effects from the chemo, and weird side effects that, you know, you see on TV, people throwing up when they have chemo, and you go, oh, that sucks, too bad for them. There's a lot of side effects from chemo that I've experienced, and I'm on some medication that I've been taking for 5 years for breast cancer, and what I've gotten is that life is short. Don't take anything for granted, because you never know if tomorrow's going to happen. Don't take anything for granted, and there are no big deals. And you know what? When they read the 12, when they read how it works, there's people in here that are going to die, you guys. There's people in here that are going to relapse. There's people in here that aren't going to make it back. And when you guys laugh and make a joke out of it, it's funny, and it's woohoo, yahoo, I loved it. There's people in here that are going to die. There's people in here that are going to go out tonight and go out tomorrow and not fucking come back. When I got sober, my ass was kicked. It was kicked. People died. I went to funerals for people that drank and relapsed. You don't get to relapse. That's what my sponsor told me. You don't get to relapse, Kelly. There's no coming back. There's no patting on the butt because you went back out. No, you don't get to relapse. Anyways, there's my little kick. There's a few people in this room who know how to stay sober. There's a lot of people in this room who know how to drink. Talk to those people who know how to stay sober. This is a life and death situation. Life and death. People will die. Our friends will die if we don't help. It's a free gift that we've been given. It's a free gift. What are you going to do with it? I'm going to close with a prayer that I like, that I try to live with. I try to live my life by every day. Because what I've learned by being sober, one day at a time, and not drinking and not dying, I've learned how to be nice. Although that wasn't nice, but so what? I've learned how to love people from my heart. I think I've learned that through having cancer. I've learned again that nothing is too serious except drinking. Nothing. Nothing is too serious. Let's hope this thing doesn't fall. Isn't this cool pink cover I have? My cool friend gave it to me. Some of you have probably read this if you've gone to the 11th step. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there's hatred I may bring love, that where there's wrong I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there's discord I may bring harmony, that where there's error I may bring truth, that where there's doubt I may bring faith, that where there's despair I may bring hope, that where there are shadows I may bring light, that where there's sadness I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one is awakened to eternal life. Amen. Thanks for listening.